Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to a special program of The Universe Next Door, and we are today really thrilled to have with us on the phone the author of a very powerful and extremely important new book, which you may have been hearing about through this broadcast in previous weeks. The name of the book is Darwin's Doubt, and the subtitle really does a great job of summarizing the case for the book. It's The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. The author who is with us today on the phone is none other than Stephen Meyer. Dr. Stephen Meyer, welcome back to The Universe Next Door.
It's good to be with you again, Tom.
Thank you so much for taking the time out from your incredibly busy schedule of interviews. I think that you have in recent days probably done more interviews than I've done in a lifetime. But we'll pray that you have the strength to continue. And I gather that the book is just becoming something of a phenomenon in our times. I mean, when I saw that it hit the number one spot in the Barnes & Noble list, it made me want to stop by my local Barnes & Noble store and thank them for carrying the book. And I went ahead and did my part of the cause and bought another copy there, even though I had gotten some in already. So I want to congratulate you on achievement. How long have you been working on this incredible book, Darwin's Doubt?
Well, it depends a little bit on how you count, but in earnest and in a very focused way for about 2 years.
Mm.
The book is an amplification of an essay that I wrote in 2004 for the Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington, the journal published out of the Smithsonian's Natural History Museum, the very article that got poor Dr. Richard Sternberg in such big trouble.
Which, oh, yes.
I'm sure you've talked with your guests about, or your audience about before.
Yes, it's featured briefly, at least in Expelled,
right,
Ben Stein
right.
Interviewing Richard Sternberg. So it was your article that got him in hot soup. But of course, that article was peer reviewed. I believe at least three peer reviewers gave it the thumbs up with certain changes being made. So that is, one of the most incredible peaks of scandalous, in my way of thinking, anti-intellectualism that we've seen from those who have responded to the art design argument. But of course, in that article, you only made the design argument briefly at the end. You were focused mainly on the Cambrian explosion. Explain for us what the Cambrian explosion is.
Well, the Cambrian explosion is the geologically sudden appearance of the major groups of animals in the fossil record. And if you review your basic geology, you remember that sedimentary rocks pile up on top of each other. The oldest ones are on the bottom. The younger ones are on the top, all other things being equal. And at a certain seam in the rock, a certain layer all around the world, you have the sudden appearance of the animal phyla, the phyla being the largest division in the classification system of animals. So each of these new phyla would represent very distinct body plans, where a body plan is a unique arrangement of body parts, organs, and tissues.
Mm-hmm.
So the first chordates in the form of some Cambrian fishes appear then, the first trilobites or arthropods in the form of trilobites and many other arthropod animals appear, the first echinoderms and right down through the list. So at least 20 phyla first appear in the Cambrian.
Wow.
And there are, by the count that we developed in the research that was done for the book, there are 36 total phyla. 10 of them have no fossil record. They're not represented in the fossil record of the remaining group. Fully 20 first appear in the Cambrian. So it's a real explosion, mm-hmm, of new form and structure.
And of course, the key rub of the argument, which really is the source of the title, Darwin's Doubt, that Darwin himself could not explain the incredible absence of precursors of the transitional forms leading up from what I guess are now called the microfossils below the Cambrian animals. Is that a persisting pattern to this day?
It is a persisting pattern, and it is the story of the book that Darwin himself acknowledged in The Origin of Species, that the the absence of ancestral precursors, you put it exactly right, in the lower Precambrian strata did not comport with the picture of the history of life that he was defending in The Origin of Species, nor did it, nor was it consistent with his understanding of the mechanism by which evolutionary change would take place. His mechanism of natural selection acting on random variations necessarily would need to act very slowly and gradually, because he envisioned that the variations must be minute and incremental, and they would accumulate over vast stretches of time. And what we see in the geological record is rather the abrupt appearance of these sophisticated, complex, intricate animal forms right from the dawn of animal life. As soon as you get animals, they're complicated, and you don't see these ancestral intermediates.
Today with us on the phone from his office in the area of Seattle, Washington, is Stephen Meyer. He is the author of a book that has been receiving a huge amount of attention in the press, and I would say the secular, the media, as much as any faith-based or religious commentators would be very fascinated with this book. On the back are blurbs from such luminary scholars of today as Dr. George Church of Harvard University, and even a Cambrian specialist at Mount Holyoke College, Dr. Mark McMenamin. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but his comment was startling. It was wonderfully revealing when he spoke about the new data increases the mystery. Are you finding that paleontologists that focus on the Cambrian explosion are struggling in this area, are struggling to explain what they see?
I think that's a fair characterization. In fact, a recent book, just this spring, by James Valentine and Doug Irwin, two leading Cambrian paleontologists, addresses the mystery kind of head on. And the review of the book that appeared in Science just a couple weeks ago said that the Cambrian explosion ranks as one of the great mysteries of evolutionary biology. So the Irwin and Valentine book very clearly defended the idea that the Cambrian explosion is a real event. For a long time, people tried to explain it away as an artifact of either our incomplete sampling of the fossil record or an artifact of the depositional environments in the Precambrian not being capable of preserving the ancestral forms. But they defend this as a real event. The record is showing that there was an abrupt appearance of animal life, and then they wrestle with how to explain it, they describe an approach, but not anything like a really definite theory.
Right. Well, in this case, the gathering of more fossils from this era, from the Cambrian segment of rock, is actually deepening the mystery, because we're finding more and more fascinating, bizarre animals. I love the word you used halfway through the book. I think you called it a carnival, and I thought that captures the image beautifully. It's just these crazy structured animals, Hallucigenia, Anomalocaris, you know, Microdictyon. These others are just beautifully represented in those color photographs right there before the middle of the book, a spectacular addition. In case you've just joined us again, the author of one of the most important books in many years, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. Really quickly, Dr. Stephen Meyer, what is your day job, if I can use that term, when you're not with George Norrie and our other publications, commentators and the media?
Well, my title is that I'm the director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute, and I'm a senior research fellow as well. And so one of the things I do is I write books and articles, scientific articles, sometimes articles for the popular press as well, op-eds and things. But my role in directing the program involves me doing a lot of other things to support the research of others of our fellows and scientists, and that we do a lot of media interviews and public talks and debates, and our basic mission is to challenge the the worldview of scientific materialism, the materialistic interpretation of science, and we do that. So we fund, sponsor, and promote research not only on the question of biological origins, but also on questions of cosmological origins, which entails both research in physics and cosmology. We're interested in the fine tuning of the universe. We're also interested in questions of mind and body and consciousness. So we run the range of topics that intersect the that are relevant to the intersection of science and philosophy, science and worldview.
Right, and of course, so many of the reports about your book are rolling out day after day on evolutionnews.org. That's a very important website, I would say, to bookmark. And evolutionnews.org, it's the kind of the main news service provided by Discovery Institute. Today we have, again, Dr. Stephen Meyer, a graduate of Cambridge University, University of Cambridge, excuse me, received his doctorate there. He is the author of A Bombshell. It is mandatory reading for anybody interested in this area of Darwiner design. We'll be right back with Dr. Meyer after a quick break on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today we have an incredibly special program. An amazing opportunity to be able to chat with the author of a book that I have been recently writing about in one of the blogs that is out there, Uncommon Descent. I have actually said, Dr. Meyer, I don't know if you heard this, that Darwin's doubt is at least equal of importance as a contribution to the Darwinism versus design theory debate as compared to the great book that Michael Behe wrote, Darwin's Black Box, or Evolution, a Theory in Crisis, that helped to launch the design movement from Michael Denton, or the great book from Phil Johnson, Darwin on Trial. I suspect this book will be almost everybody who's read it has said, a game changer. And I wanted to thank you for investing so much of your time, literally a chunk of your life, to do the research. This is, I'm holding in my hand a book that is like a crash course on where we are in the origin of animals debate. How did animals with beautiful complex structures arise? And you had some help, of course, from fellow scholars in the intelligent design movement, many people affiliated as fellows of the Discovery Institute. Let's talk about the claim that we hear some scientists saying, well, no matter what you say about the Cambrian explosion, if you check out the DNA that is pertaining, let's say, different genes that pertain to the species or the different kinds of animals that came out of there, we know that they actually broke apart, they diverged or branched apart 300 million years before the Cambrian explosion. We just haven't found the physical evidence, but they did for sure break apart due to deep divergence. Would you give us a hint of why that is not an escape route?
Sure, that's what actually, you say it very well. The hypothesis actually has a name. It's called the deep divergence hypothesis. And then basically what the evolutionary biologists who have proposed this idea are doing is this. They're acknowledging that we don't have fossil evidence of the Precambrian ancestral precursors to the Cambrian animals that first arise. But what they do is they say we have genetic evidence that there must have been an original animal way, way back from which all these other animals evolved and diverged. And the way they get to that conclusion is they analyze molecules in similar molecules in different representatives of the different phyla, and then they assume that the degree of difference of those same molecules is related to the amount of time that took place from the point at which the two different forms of life, the two animals, diverged from a common ancestor. So bigger differences mean longer time ago, smaller differences mean less time ago. The problem with these analyses is that depending on which molecules they choose to analyze, you get very different divergence points. Mm. So you don't get a clear historical signal. You get a range of times that varies really dramatically from just a few tens or 100 million years before the Cambrian event to a couple of billion, depending on which molecule you choose. And yet there really can only be one divergence point, one common ancestor. So when you get that wide a variety of dates, it makes you wonder if you're really getting anything like a true historical signal, whether these methods are telling you anything. And then there's a deeper problem, and that is that the computer programs that analyze the sequence similarities or differences are programmed in advance to generate a tree-like pattern. In other words, the assumption of a common ancestor is built into the way in which the analysis is performed. So there's no way you would get anything other than the conclusion that a divergence occurred at some point in the past.
So it's a circular kind of
argument.
It's
a question-begging type of method. It assumes at the outset the very thing that is supposedly proved by the method, which is that there was a common ancestor a long time ago. You can't put that data into the program and not get that conclusion. You will get the program telling you that there was a common ancestor at some point. And so I don't think it really establishes very much. In fact, I think it's completely begs the question. So, it's not a very persuasive thesis. And it's so, the numbers that these analyses get are so at odds with each other and so at odds with the fossil record that there's growing skepticism within the paleontology community, at least, that these results are meaningful at all.
Today with us on the phone, Stephen Meyer. Yeah, Dr. Stephen Meyer is a graduate of University of Cambridge with his PhD in the philosophy of science. He has taught at the college level. He's been a researcher. He's even had an appointment as a professor here in the area of Florida where we live, at least on the other side, Palm Beach Atlantic College and now Palm Beach Atlantic University. He is the author of an extremely important new breakthrough book. It is called Darwin's Doubt. It is available on our website, apologetics.org. That's apologetics.org. Just click on either the Darwin's Doubt feature box on the front page, or you can go straight to our web store. Just click on the store tab above the Oxford skyline. It is available for purchase, and we are throwing in a little freebie, and that is a sleeved copy of Darwin's Dilemma, which is the brilliant film, came out just a few years ago, paralleling this book, and that is, of course, by Illustra Media, and that will be tucked in your package when you order Darwin's Doubt. Just make sure you order that soon, because we're going to be offering this for a number of weeks, and we just want you to get your copy, or call. I would say get two or three copies. You probably would agree with that, Steve Meyer, that people then can share it with those who may be struggling in this area. Have you, in your experience of speaking in these states on all over the world on this topic, have you seen any glimmers of new openness among scholars who may not be that friendly toward the Judeo-Christian worldview or a religious worldview at all? Are people literally looking for other ways of thinking about this debate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. in the book, I address this because I talk about the post-Darwinian or post-neo-Darwinian evolutionary theories that are being proposed. And I actually look at six or seven of those models. Frenzy to generate some new approaches to evolutionary theory is a byproduct of the recognition by an increasing number of biologists and even evolutionary biologists that the mechanism, the classical neo-Darwinian mechanism of random mutations and natural selection is not adequate. It does not have the creative power necessary to account for the new form and the new information necessary to build that form that arises in the Cambrian explosion. And that's really the second mystery of the book. And we've been talking about the mystery of the missing ancestral fossils, something that Darwin was aware of and which has not been resolved by subsequent fossil finds. But the second mystery is really an engineering problem. It's the question of how would the evolutionary process, how would anyone or anything build an animal as complex as what we're seeing. And I think an increasing number of evolutionary biologists have recognized that purely random mutations with natural selection is not sufficient. And so you see that in conferences like the one that occurred in Europe a couple of years ago. The group of evolutionary biologists called the Altenburg 16 met to discuss different new approaches to evolutionary theory. It was essentially a call for a new theory of evolution. And you also see it in the theories that are being formulated. They clearly imply, as Simon Conway Morris has said, that we live in a post-Darwinian era. So one of the things I do in the book is show, for five separate, independent but complementary reasons, why the classical mechanism of neo-Darwinism, random mutation and natural selection, is not sufficient to build the new animal form that arises in the Cambrian, and the closely related question of the origin of information is also something that neo-Darwinism is having a really hard time explaining.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you said in your book, really echoing what the late and great Stephen Jay Gould, the Harvard paleontologist, had said, that neo-Darwinism is effectively dead, even though it persists as textbook orthodoxy. And I think that you echoed, maybe perhaps with those same words, but we're going to have to take a break here in just about 30 seconds. One of the things that I wanted to just stress about anybody interested in this debate over the book itself, Darwin's Doubt, which we are featuring today, actually Stephen Meyer, the author, has achieved an unparalleled breakthrough in surfacing all the major factors, themes, problems, ideas, and he's analyzed in such a thorough and clear way. It's like a course, taking a course through one book. The book again, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design, authored by Stephen Meyer. He'll be staying with us for a little bit more. We're going to be right back here on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to our discussion with Dr. Stephen Meyer, the author of this incredible new book, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and The Case for Intelligent Design. I might add that Steve Meyer is not only the author of this tremendous book, but also brought out just a few years ago an equally important book, I would say, in the big picture of things, and that was entitled Signature in the Cell, a really great analysis, very thorough, of the question of how did the first cell evolve unassisted by intelligence from some kind of chemical soup or undifferentiated group of raw materials floating around in a sea or on a dry land section or on a crystal, as we hear Michael Ruse say in that famous quote in the Expelled movie. Today, we again are looking not so much at the origin of life as Signature in the Cell looked at, but also now the origin of animals, the complex critters that just appear abruptly. Dr. Meyer, you have assisted, and I believe you're one of the commentators on that great video, the DVD, Darwin's Dilemma. Would you recommend that along with this book?
Oh, I think it's a tremendous compliment to the book. Compliment in the sense that the two things go nicely together.
Yeah, with the E, with the yes, CMPLE.
Right.
Exactly.
And the video presentation, I think, brings to life a number of the things that I discuss in the book. So I think they'd go nicely together. Yeah.
Yes, and let me just add.
And our friends at Illustra do fantastic work, of course.
Top drawer. It's just fantastic. The book and the video together will be provided. We're going to slip the Darwin's Dilemma DVD in a sleeve form right in there with the Stephen Meyer book, Darwin's Doubt, when you order that on apologetics.org, apologetics.org. And we want to just remind you that another great DVD that's out just in the last few weeks is called Flight, The Genius of Birds. That's flight as in take off on an airplane, but in this case, it's birds. Flight, The Genius of Birds, also from the same wonderful company, Illustra Media. My wife and I watched it with our daughter and with her husband, an Army captain, and their two little kids, age 6 and 7. We were enthralled. And Steve Meyer, this is really, I think, a test case. The 6 and 7-year-old did not look away for 1 hour. How's that?
No, that's great. I mean, if you bring things alive and visually, people are interested.
It is
a fascinating story.
It is. And I want to congratulate you for your success in illustrating your book, Darwin's Doubt, with so many powerful illustrations, both black and white throughout, in that section with color pictures of fossils. That was a great idea. And hats off, of course, to Harper One. It's an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Harper One, based in San Francisco, is doing a great job of publicizing the book. It has been high ranking in Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And yeah, I'm blown away with this turning point that we're literally living through, a moment in history that is very exciting, as the potential is there for a revolution in thought, some maybe parallel and going in a different direction from Darwin's own revolution 160 almost years ago. So let's talk about the post-Darwinian world a little bit more, because after you present the problem of the Cambrian explosion, the sudden appearance of so many diverse and yet very highly organized, highly complex animals, you say that there are attempts made by some scholars to find an escape route or an explanation for how those animals could have formed so quickly without the assistance of intelligence. Tell us a bit about the Stuart Kaufman self-organizational view. Is there some hope in at least certain quarters that his ideas might provide some or shed some light on this problem?
Well, just to put the question in context, it might be helpful to understand just a little bit more what the problem is that needs to be explained.
Okay.
And it really is a problem of the origin of information. We know about Watson Crick's discovery in 1953, and we know, and then 4 years later, Francis Crick proposed something called the sequence hypothesis. He and Watson had discerned the structure of the DNA molecule, but Crick realized that there were four chemical subunits called bases that ran along the spine of the DNA that functioned just like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters, the zeros and ones in a section of computer code, which is to say it was the precise sequence of those chemicals that conveyed instructions for building the proteins that are necessary to keep cells alive. Now, when we think about a Cambrian animal coming online in the fossil record, we are invariably confronted with really dramatic new forms of life. Mm-hmm. And each of those forms of life comes with new types of cells. Arthropods first come online in the Cambrian. They have external hard skeletons. They also have guts. Many of the animals that came online, therefore, would have digestive enzymes to service those gut cells. And so every time there's a new type of animal, there are new cell types. But each new cell type requires new dedicated proteins, which in turn gets you back to the DNA, because the DNA has the information for building the proteins. So when you see an explosion of new animal form and complexity, you realize there must be new cell types. New cell types require new proteins. New proteins require new DNA. And so the Cambrian explosion is not just an explosion of form. It's an explosion of information. Now, in addition to the genetic information, and this is something you and Dr. Gills have written about, there's also the need for epigenetic information. We now know that not all the information necessary to build an animal form is embedded in the DNA. The DNA makes the proteins, but the proteins have to be organized into higher level structures. And those structures may form cell types. The cell types have to be organized into tissues, and tissues need to be organized into organs, and organs and tissues into whole body plans. And the DNA provides some of that information, the information for building the proteins, but not how to organize the proteins into all those higher level structures. So there's this need for another layer of information in building a whole animal. And that's the fundamental problem. When we think about the Cambrian explosion as an engineering problem, we have to be able to explain the origin of the genetic and this epigenetic layer of information to account for the origin of animals. And so as scientists have recognized that neo-Darwinism can't do that, they've proposed other models. And one of those is the self-organizational theory that you were asking about.
And of course, the self-organizational theory, perhaps best known in conjunction with the work of Stuart Kaufman, Once affiliated with Santa Fe Institute, which devotes a large part of its budget to this study, is really not produced as a kind of a caveat. That approach hasn't produced much in the way of experimental results or really experimentation at all. Could you, in about a minute and a half, characterize what are they saying and what is the problem?
The idea of self-organization is, instead of relying on random variations or mutations to generate new form, they want to rely on some kind of self-organizational laws, maybe chemical processes or physics of attraction or some kind of law-like process. And they point to some interesting processes that are definitely at work in nature. But the question is whether or not, first of all, those law-like processes produce anything like information. Information isn't the kind of thing that can be described as a law. Law-like processes describe patterns of repetitive order, like a crystal of salt, has NaCl, NaCl, NaCl over and over and over again.
It's very boring.
Very boring and repetitive. Yeah. That's not informational. It's redundant. Right. The same old thing happening over and over again doesn't convey anything new, mm-hmm. no new information. And so that's one problem. But another problem in the models that the self-organizationalists have proposed for explaining something like the origin of animals is that they tend to beg the question of prior sources of information. They're pointing to real processes, but those processes only work if there are prior sources of genetic and epigenetic information. There's one self-organizationalist named Stuart Newman, is a fantastic biologist, and Kaufman, for his part, is a brilliant scientist. But the processes they point to only work if there is a prior source of information. Newman, in his model, actually presupposes a genetic toolkit prior to the Cambrian explosion. Well, obviously, that toolkit has to be explained. And then some of the other processes that he points to presuppose epigenetic sources of information. So there's some real science involved in what they're talking about, but it's not their models presuppose but don't explain the fundamental sources of information, the fundamental problem, which is the pre-existing information that's necessary to build the animals.
On the phone with us today, Dr. Stephen Meyer. He is a graduate of the University of Cambridge in England, a PhD in the philosophy of science. He is a wonderful writer. He has just graced us as the reading public of Planet Earth with two bombshell books. One of them, Signature in the Cell, came out in late 2009. It was awarded the Book of the Year, or one of the top books of the year, by the Times Literary Supplement in London. And I think they do that book a great service. Even the atheist philosopher recommended it. Tom Nagel recommended the book for that award. And now, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. We're going to learn more about that case for design when we continue with Stephen Meyer on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today we are navigating through a galaxy of discoveries and very carefully argued responses to Darwinian ideas that has been put together by a great author. His name is Dr. Stephen Meyer. He's with us today on the phone from his office there in the Seattle, Washington area. He has been on staff very much leading the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute, having previously served as a professor of philosophy. Was it at Whitworth College?
Whitworth University,
for a number of years. And he did his original dissertation really on this whole idea of design versus descent at Cambridge University. He is an experienced debater, but he enjoys, I think, just maybe more, even more, presenting the carefully thought out reflection on what we're finding in nature. I don't know if I've said that accurately, but I think you enjoy the opportunity to let people think and let them express their thoughts, and then you interact with their thoughts.
Well, I taught freshmen for a number of years, and I really think that that's a great training for anyone trying to communicate ideas, because you got to break it down, and that's what I try to do in the book is strike a balance between developing the argument in the most rigorous way possible, and also at the same time trying to teach the science necessary to understand the argument and weave in a story element as well. So it's a kind of a challenge, but it's a fun communication challenge.
I can imagine. Part three of your book, Dr. Meyer, says it's entitled After Darwin, What? I love that. After Darwin, what are the options? And of course, you deal with this entire burgeoning, exploding world of ideas, not just self-organization, like the ones, you know, some of that and some of the other ideas we just discussed, but others. I'm thinking of like natural genetic engineering and some of these other ideas. I know panspermia is not really developed as a...
Well, you've got what's called Evo-Devo, evolutionary mm-hmm. developmental biology, and there's a neo-Lamarckian approach to evolutionary theory that brings in some of the ideas that you're familiar with epigenetics. Mm-hmm. And the neutral theory of evolution that dispenses with any role for natural selection altogether and just relies entirely on random genetic changes and what's called genetic drift. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of models now that are being proposed to really address the problem that has been left unsolved by classical neo-Darwinism, namely the origin of form. There was a major book in 2003 published by two leading evolutionary and evolutionary biologists and a theoretical biologist, and the book was called On the Origin of Organismal Form. And it was a collection of essays by leading people in evolutionary biology. And the opening essay cataloged unsolved problems in evolutionary theory, one of which was the Cambrian explosion. But another that was listed in this table of unsolved problems was the origin of form. And I remember when I read that, it was just very striking because if you go back to 1859, the terminology is a little different. Darwin says he's writing on the origin of species, but he's talking about the very same question. How do we generate fundamentally new forms of life? And this MIT Press book, now 10 years old, was saying, look, that fundamental question is now, again, an open question. It has gone unsolved. The two authors said in their opening essay that neo-Darwinism is still the standard textbook orthodox theory, but it has no theory of the generative. It explains, as one and some other biologists put it, the survival but not the arrival of the fittest. It does not explain the origin of fundamentally new forms of life. And I pick up on that theme and look at the different models that have been proposed to try to explain that. But I show that any theory of the origin of form must explain the origin of the information necessary to build the form. And that's where we see all the different models founder. There's the neo-Darwinism failed to do that. The new models have various virtues and advantages over neo-Darwinism. But what I show in the book is that, first of all, there's no universal assent or consensus around any one of the models. And secondly, that none of them succeed in explaining this most fundamental question about the origin of the genetic and the epigenetic information that you need to build an animal.
Okay, you mentioned the Evo-Devo, and I've heard of that, and I was wondering if you could just, in a few, maybe a half a minute to a minute, what is Evo-Devo, so that we can just hear a quick overview, and then what is the problem with invoking that as an escape route for the Cambrian explosion?
Well, the evolutionary, Evo-Devo is short for evolutionary developmental biology, and these group of scientists wanted to have said that we need to bring our understanding of developmental biology, of embryology, into our understanding of how animals develop. And I think that's absolutely true. The problem is they end up invoking processes which we actually know don't work. We know from developmental biology that if you mutate, if mutations are expressed very early in development, as they would need to be in order to generate a fundamentally new form of life, you'd have to mutate the organism early in the process so that it would affect all the different cells that develop downstream. But the problem is that experimentally, when scientists have produced these early acting body plan mutations, as they're called, they invariably produce not just deleterious mutations but lethals. They produce development shuts down. The animals actually die, and so the Evo Devo crowd is right. We've got to look at developmental processes, but mutating and altering those developmental processes is a very tricky thing. It seems to invariably produce or generate lethals that bring the evolutionary process to a termination point. So it's a tough road to hoe.
Right. And so in your book, in case you've just joined The Universe Next Door, we have today Stephen Meyer's book, Darwin's Doubt. It is out now. It has been just generating tremendous excitement and quite a bit of controversy as it's being discussed in the airwaves, on TV and radio and the media, the press. I want to just quickly go now, Steve, to the bottom line approach that you bring to this book, which is we don't just have a failure of these neo-Darwinian or post-Darwinian models and ideas. We have an emerging picture, a clarity of intelligent design. Someone says, let's say in a debate or a discussion with you, intelligent design is not science. It invokes a religious idea. How would you respond to that?
Well, the same way I'd respond to another way of framing the same objection, which is, well, you've made a compelling critique of neo-Darwinism, but how do you get from that to a positive case for intelligent design? And here's the answer. I've been thinking about this question since the mid-80s when I was off to grad school. And as I was first thinking about it, I delved into the works of Darwin himself. And not only because I was interested in the way he made his case for evolution, but also because I was interested in the scientific method that he was using to reconstruct events in the remote past. Obviously, if you're trying to explain the origin of trilobites or the origin of cells in the first place, you can't replicate those events in the laboratory under controlled conditions. So you're doing a different kind of science, a more forensic style or historical style of science, where you're reasoning from the clues that we have in front of us back to the causes of the events you're trying to explain. And when you're using that type of method, or as Darwin used that type of method, he had a simple rule of reasoning that he got from his mentor, Charles Lyell, the great geologist, which is that if you're trying to explain an event in the remote past, you want to invoke a cause which we know from present experience is capable of producing that effect or that event. And as I applied that, as I began to think about that, I thought, you know, that applies to the question of the origin of information. We're at an impasse with various naturalistic attempts to explain the origin of information, but there is a cause of which we know from our present experience that's capable of generating information. And that cause is intelligence. Whether we, you know, see information in a hieroglyphic inscription or in a book or a newspaper or embedded in a radio signal, and we trace that information back to its ultimate source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. So when we see an event in the history of life like the Cambrian explosion, which is nothing less than an explosion of information, an infusion of information into the biosphere, I argue that we're looking at decisive evidence for the prior activity of an intelligent cause, an intelligent agent. Information points back to intelligence because there's only one known cause of that intelligence. So I concluded not only that intelligent design does provide the best explanation for this explosion of information, but also that you could formulate the case for intelligent design as a positive scientific argument, one in fact based on the same method of scientific reasoning that Darwin himself used.
Well, I'm looking on page 357 where you are quoting a bit from Irwin and Davidson's work, and you say they have actually given a profile of the suspect, that is, the suspect that could pull this off. The cause of the Cambrian explosion must be capable of generating new form rapidly. Well, only intelligence does that, as you point out. Generating a top-down pattern of appearance. Only the top-down patterns that we see today come from intelligence. Thirdly, constructing, not merely modifying, complex integrated circuits. Only intelligence does that. I think this is a fantastic key page, page 357 in this book. If I can just go ahead and give you a final recommendation opportunity to our listening audience in about 40 seconds, what would you encourage people to think about as they enter this subject, the topic of origins?
Well, before I answer that, I should hasten to add that Irwin and Davidson are not advocates of intelligence design, but they get right up to the water's edge, in my opinion.
Right. You know? Okay. Good caveat.
But I think well, it's just a fascinating topic, and it ramifies out in every direction. It's interdisciplinary scientifically, and there's a great story associated with it. I tried to write the Darwin's Doubt as a mystery story, and the story is the story of Darwin's Doubt and what's become of it. And my argument is that what's become of it is the doubt has deepened, and it has deepened to the point that it has created an impasse in evolutionary biology, a crisis in the orthodox theory of neo-Darwinism, that no other naturalistic theory has succeeded in replacing it. And the best explanation, based on the principles of reasoning that we have inherited from Darwin himself, should lead us to the conclusion that there's evidence of intelligent design. Once you get to that point, then maybe this is the point of reflection for all thinking people and for people in your audience. Well, what do we make of that? Who is that designer? What does that mean about the bigger metaphysical and worldview questions?
Okay.
And that's an exciting point of reflection.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Stephen Meyer, for Darwin's Doubt. We'll see you back here next week on The Universe Next Door.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.